When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. It's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Elizabeth Eva Leach about medieval sex lives, the sounds of courtly intimacy on the Francophone borders. So welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. This has both got a wonderful title and is a fascinating sort of academic book, but also and this is a bit of a cliche, so I apologize. It's kind of a bit of a sort of detective story, I think, as well, about a fascinating folio manuscript collection. And I'm interested to start off with where the idea for the book came from, really, and how your sort of, I guess, kind of digging around in the archive gave rise to the book.
Yeah, so I'd actually been working on slightly later repertoire on the composer Guillaume de Machaut, who is 1300 to 1377. And I was looking for a new project, having published a book on him. And I was kind of interested. I got sent some books to review where the books were editions of various parts of this manuscript that is known under the shelf mark of Douse 308. And they had lots of lyrics in there, lots of songs, no musical notation, but all of the songs were arranged in genre subsections, including some genres like the ballets and the chansons, which I hadn't really come across before. And this is really from the period immediately before the stuff I'd been working on. So this is the immediate heritage of Guillaume de Machaut. And so I was just curious about these relatively unfamiliar genres. And there is a bit of a gap in the sources for music around 1300. So, of course, we've got this unnotated book. There's no musical notation in it, but it's quite clearly a pointer to musical practices. And that's kind of what we have to do at this point. We have to be a bit creative as musicologists to look at unnotated sources to see what they can tell us about music. Interestingly, the manuscript itself, Douse 308, was local to me. It's in the Bodleian Library in Oxford, where I'm based and where I live. And I had a sabbatical in 2013, just after I'd done all of these reviews of various editions of these lyrics that had been in this manuscript. And I unfortunately broke a bone in my foot and ended up on crutches, not able to get into the libraries or do anything. It was sort of like a prototype for lockdown, really. And during that period, all I could really do was put together a grant application. So I wrote a grant application to the Leverhulme Trust, who very kindly indeed funded the work for this book. I had 3 years looking at the Douse 308 manuscript, only to find out that it wasn't exactly the manuscript that I thought it was. I thought it was a whole manuscript that was all put together in this sort of holistic way, and I was going to write a biography of the manuscript. And it wasn't like that. It's got a lot of different things in it, a lot of different contents. It's a composite manuscript, but there's a core to it. And the core is these eight genre subsections of over 500 songs and an interesting poem about a tournament called the Tournament at Chauvency.
If that's a bit about the content, I wonder if you could set it in the context of both its geography and its time.
Yes. So the current state of the manuscript, we think it was bound together with its contents as they currently are in the 15th century. But the contents themselves were probably put together in the very early 14th century, I think around about 1313. And it's clear that some of the contents that are there now were part of a different manuscript. There's another bit of it that's in the British Library, for example. The version that we've got, and the reason it's called Douce 308, is that Francis Douce was an early 19th century collector. He had actually ended up getting a massive bequest from a sculptor that he knew in 1823, and he bought all sorts of things. He was very interested in manuscripts that had nice pictures, and this has got lots of nice illuminations in it. And when he died in, I think, the 1830s, he left his books to the Bodleian, including 420 manuscripts, of which this is number 308. It's a parchment manuscript, and the American scholar Nancy Freeman Regalado said it's a complete kit of secular chivalry. Well, it is in the state that it's in now, but art historian Alison Stones has really suggested that it is a sort of things that are put together that didn't originally sit together. So how it looks at the moment, it's got a long poem called The Vows of the Peacock, which is part of a late Alexander cycle about Alexander the Great. It's got a prose work by Richard de Fourneval called The Bestiary of Love, which is a sort of weird mashup of a bestiary and a love letter. And then it's got these contents, which we think are the only things which were definitely in the original ordering, which is the tournament at Chauvency, which is a versified account of a real tournament that actually took place. And I'll probably talk more about that later. And then it's got these over 500 songs arranged in their eight genre subsections. After that, it's got a tournament, something called the Tournament of Antichrist by Huon de Mergy. And just before that, there's a sort of single page from another work, the rest of which is in that British Library manuscript, which also has an apocalypse work in it as well. So the current thing is a composite, but the central bit and the bit that I became increasingly interested in and about which this book is talking are the songs and the tournament at Chauvency.
One of the things you mentioned there was this kind of idea of there being a sort of a guide or did you call it a kind of a kit for love at court? And this conception of courtly love is really crucial to the book and to your analysis. And actually, you know, it's a sort of a topic, a subject that various writers from a lot of different areas and different approaches have written about. And I wonder if you could kind of unpack courtly love for me, partially because it obviously, you know, animates the book's analysis, but also I think it's, again, a really important kind of bit of context setting for the work you've been doing.
Yeah, sure. I mean, courtly love, you know, it's a lot of different things. It's a 19th century invention for a start. So Gaston Paris coined the phrase amour courtois in 1883. And he was really looking at what he saw as a new way of people relating to one another erotically in Chrétien de Troyes' Chevalier de la Charette. That term then got translated into English and became quite central to a book by C.S. Lewis, where he really said it was actually a real medieval thing. He outlined four components of it, which were humility, courtesy, adultery, and the religion of love. And then subsequent to that, the scholars really argued about it and kind of rejected it as a term. Lots of people said it's sort of anachronistic, or it was mistranslated, or it was a bad form of labelling. And particularly as scholarly fashions changed and people weren't really so interested in how these literary works related to real life or to historical episodes or events, essentially, as people were sort of really treating works in a more structuralist way, they sort of didn't like the sort of sociological framing of courtly love, and they sort of really tried to stop people using it. And so people would use a workaround like finamour or something else. They would just sort of talk about specific genres. I'm actually not using it to mean courtly love in the sense of love which is very much codified and defined. I use it much more to think about what love in its broadest sense might mean at the court. And that's the court in its broadest sense as well. I mean, actually, in some senses, courtly love tropes, the sorts of things that keep cropping up in courtly love literature and courtly love poetry are an enduring cultural phenomenon even today. I heard recently a podcast, one of the episodes from Not Just the Tudors that they originally put out in 2021, but they actually just re-released over Christmas. And in it, Sarah Griswood was talking about how the Tudors reenacted these roles of the devoted lover and the capricious mistress, and, you know, that they were sort of taking the romances of medieval literature and turning them into a more sort of historical practice. And that this then got rediscovered in the Romantic period in the 19th century. And it's filtered right through into pop songs and into popular culture more broadly. And I think that's true. I think a lot of the tropes that are in these pieces of literature are still with us. That doesn't mean they're the same, and it doesn't mean they have the same kinds of resonance.
Yeah, it's particularly tricky, isn't it, trying to sort of reconstruct the uses of practices around music. And one of the things I think the book does really well is it's quite sort of open and foregrounds its use of things like contemporary theory and draws from other areas of both scholarly and kind of cultural practice. And we'll talk a bit about that later, actually, in when we get into the later section of the book. The final kind of bit of context setting is this question about, so where does music fit in here? Yeah, and again, you sort of touched on this already in terms of how these sort of practices were both constructed then and also reinterpreted, reimagined, fantasized at various other historical points. But yeah, what's going on with music's role at court, and I guess kind of more broadly in the sexual and cultural scripts of court too?
Yeah, so I mean, this relates to the methodological thing that I hit upon in the end to use to try and understand how these songs had remained current for such a long time. So the songs that are in Dowse 308 go back a couple of hundred years. So there's songs in there from the late 12th century. And, you know, why was courtly love such a thing for such a long period of time? Was it, why did it persist in being useful and interesting to people? And I think part of that is to do with the sorts of sexual scripts that it contains, but part of it is also to do with the fact that it is sung. And singing and music making have a particular kind of power over people. Most people who have any kind of feeling for music today could relate to that idea that we are emotionally affected by music. We're also able to inscribe text quite well in our memories because of it being sung. So music is this very, very good link to memory. Modern psychological studies have shown that seems to be the case. Which meant that it could mediate between the three different levels of sexual scripting, which I was using methodologically. So this is thinking about a broad cultural script that everyone knows about, so sort of communal script that's just out there, then to sort of more interpersonal scripts. So we see this happening in some of the musical games that are happening in the tournament at Chauvency, where people are exchanging little musical tags with one another in a sort of, not quite like a rap battle, but that kind of musical competition or musical game. And then also because it features in memory, you can remember, you can recollect music, you can think about music, or you can think about the words that were set to a piece of music that you know really well, or a little refrain, a little piece of melody that you might know that has text, and those things can perhaps be used intrapsychically for your own personal fantasy life. And you know, part of the understanding that I had of how sexuality functions is to do with the importance of individual fantasy. But that individual fantasy is not based on nothing. It's based on interpersonal and broadly more cultural scripts that are being offered by the cultural products that people are participating in.
And what sort of, we'd call them erotic scripts, are we talking about here? I wonder if you can give some examples from, some of the sort of works earlier on in 308, before we get into the more, I suppose, kind of formal things around the tournament a bit later.
Yeah, so the sort of most prestigious genre of courtly song, and the genre that is copied in the first subsection, there's just over 90 of these songs in there, is called the grand chant. So this is the high style song. In this, you've typically got a male je, a male first person lyric subject who is sort of addressing his lady or talking about her, and sometimes doing both. Often he's sort of saying how much he's suffering, saying that he's dying for his love of the lady. People have already talked extensively about the masochistic nature of courtly love in that regard. You know, he's enjoying the pain that comes from love because it comes from his lady. But I wanted to also see other possibilities there. Is there a sense in which he, as the only speaking subject in the song, is sort of kind of guilt tripping the listening lady by, you know, making it clear that she is doing this thing to him? And is he sort of forcing her to take pity on him? And in what sense does that work in a real life performance situation where it might not just be one lady who's listening to this, but there might be a whole court of mixed lords and ladies together? And who's identifying with who? I wanted to sort of think through that kind of situation. So really to see these things as much more performative, I think, than they had been viewed before. The grand chant have within them a few Marian chansons, and I was interested in looking at those. They have been talked about as a way of sort of seeing an analogical or allegorical link between the remote courtly lady love object and the Virgin Mary, who's the typical dedicatee of these songs. But I just wondered whether there was something also there that was almost a sort of, I used the phrase asexual erotics, thinking about a form of eroticism that is in some sense asexual, and therefore gave certain people with certain sexual proclivities some kind of sexual script. So that then relates to the third sort of thing, which has very similar performing type to the grand chant and the Marian songs, which is these things called sot chansons, which are quite a rare kind of chanson. And there's quite a few of them in this manuscript. And as far as we can tell, we don't have many surviving melodies. In fact, no surviving melodies for these. One of them seems to be a contrefact with a grand chant, so we might be able to posit a melody for that. And what that means is that, you know, musically, there's no difference between a sot chanson and a grand chant. But in terms of the text, the sot chanson, it literally means a foolish song or a drunken song. Those are songs which are incredibly obscene, or, you know, they can be things like I love my lady and I love her shit because it comes from my lady. So there's a sense in which there's, you know, bodily functions feature, sexual functions feature. Sometimes they're sort of clearly quite odd. There's one in which he praises his lady and talks about all her physical features in a way you might expect in a grand chant, but it's clear that the physical features being described mean that his lady is actually a cow, like literally the animal, the cow. People have talked about the sot chanson as parodic, as a way of sort of being the flip side of the grand chant. And I think that's definitely true. But I wanted to go again, I wanted to broaden out and see, is there a legitimate sexual identification that people can have here? You know, are there in fact various well-attested paraphilias that are being explored here that certain people listening to these songs would have found genuinely enticing, arousing, fantasy material, not just funny, not just sending up the grand chant, but actually giving access to various kinds of what we might today see as minority sexual practices.
On that, I wonder if we might jump forward to later in the book, and we'll close by talking about the tournament. Later on in the book, I think you sort of engage more explicitly with sort of contemporary or modern theories of sexuality, and there's a lot of discussion of kind of theatre and performance as well. And just thinking of sort of crystallising this into a question you can actually answer, could you maybe introduce the music, the pastorals that are in the later part of 308, but then perhaps kind of comment on how you're bringing in ideas about sexuality and ideas about performance too?
Yeah, so I mean, what is a pastoral? It's one of those questions that is difficult to answer. I think the pastoral has been very much defined circularly based on the positing of a classic type of pastoral that is really current later than the period that I'm talking about. In this period, I think we have to take seriously the fact that there is a pastoral subsection that's labelled here and includes a lot of songs in it that we wouldn't normally put in that pastoral category. So the pastoral category that people can relate to and that is normally posited is essentially a knight is out on his way in the countryside. He encounters a shepherdess and ... He approaches her, propositions her. She might laugh at him, run away. She might say yes. She might say no. He might rape her. Her boyfriend, Robin, might appear from the bushes and clock the knight on the head with a club. There's all sorts of ways it can pan out. So it's a sort of general scene that is set up. And then the way it might play out is differs from pastoral to pastoral. So that's a classic type. And there's a sort of subtype in which the knight instead just watches voyeuristically peasants having fun, either in a larger group doing dancing and singing, or in a couple who are having an argument or otherwise engaged. But actually in Douse 308, there are loads of other kinds of things in that pastoral subsection that are also scenes of a kind. So there's one in which a nun and a monk get together. So the monk sort of comes along and rescues the nun from the nunnery and they run off together. There's various mother-daughter exchanges. And there are lots of these so-called mal marié songs, the song of the ill-wed wife. So it's usually a wife lamenting the fact that, you know, why does my husband beat me when all I'm doing is lying naked with my lover and he's just an idiot, my husband, and I need to punish him by just going and seeing my lover, and I'm going to get naked with my lover because it will teach my husband not to beat me. So there's a lot of sort of difficult issues here. So there's lots of sexual violence, rape, domestic violence. But I wanted, and, you know, modern scholars have very much drawn on feminist theory for talking about these things. And there's some very good stuff there from feminist theorists who were really writing against some of the earlier scholarly approaches in the 19th century and the early 20th century, where people had found these pastorals sort of fun and amusing and charming, when clearly they're sort of in one sense not at all charming. But there was just something in the tournament at Chauvency that gave me pause, where there is a pastoral type dance that is done with a scene with a shepherd and a shepherdess, where it turns out that the person who is dancing the part of the shepherd is revealed to be, in fact, a noble woman. And so what you've got is two noble women playing at being shepherd and shepherdess, which I think then gives a number of different kinds of identifications and makes it seem much more clearly a fantasy possibility, and particularly a fantasy possibility for women. I'm not, of course, not excluding the interpretations that are already out there, but I just wanted to broaden out from those to think about the way that gender and role play, playing with gender, playing with the different roles, might be suggested by the that particular scene of the Rob Adele dance in the tournament at Chevancy, and that the inclusion of certain kinds of things in the pastoral subsection could show how that might be done. So one of the pieces that I talk about briefly is a song that's actually quite well known because it's been widely recorded by modern groups, which is a song called Pourquoi me bat mes maris? Why does my husband beat me? And it's normally seen as this mal marié song, but I think it does also allow someone to stage a persona in which it's possible to read the je, the speaking woman, as a sort of BDSM brat. So this sort of idea of a sub kind of asking for it in this bratish way. And I actually found there was quite a lot of interesting secondary literature, often from sociologists, but also from ethnographers, studying BDSM scenes and BDSM subcultures in various parts of the world. And that really was quite useful. Additional stuff that I found useful was stuff on theatre and stuff also on live action role playing. So anything really where people are doing a sort of scene and exploring that sort of actually quite that edge play or that edgy play between reality and play acting, but also play acting things which are on the edge of acceptability or even perhaps over that edge as a way of sort of enjoying the frisson of power, of transgression, of power play, that kind of thing.
In the tournament several times, and there you give an example of one, I guess, kind of part of music within it. What's going on in terms of, and again, you've said a couple of times that, you know, a real event, but also this is a kind of, I suppose, sort of literary construction within 308. I wonder if you could kind of introduce it, but also give a sense of why music matters and I guess why it's the kind of centerpiece to the book too.
Yeah. So, I mean, this poem is really quite interesting. It is supposedly of a real event that happened in 1284 at a place called Chevancy-le-Château, which still exists. There's a really good translation of this, so if people are interested, you should look out the Nigel Bryant translation of the Tournament of Chevancy, which was published in 2020 with Boydell and Brewer. It is, as well as the details of the tournament, there's a sort of opening frame in which the author meets a nobleman from Alsace in a forest and has this funny conversation with him because he's a German speaker who's trying to speak French. And it's actually the first depiction of a German speaking French that we have in French literature. And, you know, he conjugates the verbs wrongly, he gets the wrong tenses, he gets the word order wrong. He does a lot of funny stuff in his French. So it's clearly quite a comic poem. And then we have people coming from all over. Alsatian nobleman is that there's going to be a tournament and he should bring all his guys from Alsace over for this tournament. And indeed, they all arrive on the 1st of October at this castle at Chevancy. And there's a sort of evening, Sunday evening food and drink. And then Monday and Tuesday, they have a whole series of jousts. On Wednesday, there's a bit of a rest day because they need to plan the Thursday melee fight. So these are really the two types of tournament activity that we would have in this period. And this is on the borderlands between the French kingdoms and the empire. So this is sort of right in Lotharingia, in this sort of in the area around Metz. So we've got people who are coming from the empire, we've got people who are coming from Flanders, we've got people who are coming from France, we've got people who are coming from sort of other small local things. It's a real sort of meeting point of these nobles. And supposedly all of these people are real people. They're not only named, but we get details of their heraldry, which are depicted in the miniatures. And they can all pretty much be identified. All the people who work on heraldry use this as one of the major sources of thinking about people's heraldry in this period. But unusually, music making and conversation are also described by the poem as well. And the poem itself is sort of very oral. A lot of it's direct speech. It's very sort of vocal. The music that is described is mainly these things which are called refrains. So they're these little emotionally charged musical phrases, usually a couplet of poetry with a simple tune or a sort of lick that would be very memorable and would be easy for people to sing. They're often singing them communally, and they sing them in particular kinds of contexts. So when they're going to the field and when they're coming home from the field, the men and the women sort of tend to take each other by the hand and sing these refrains. But then there are a couple of more set piece musical things that happen in the evening. One of them I've already talked about with this Robberdale dance, where the two noble women dress as a shepherd and a shepherdess. But there's also something called the garland game, which happens on the Thursday evening. So it's the sort of last thing that they do before they leave on the Friday. And the garland game is that competitive refrain exchange between actually a minstrel and the most senior noble woman who is there. But that's not the only thing we get. We get sort of lots of shouting and crying and people's battle cries as they go into the melee. We also get descriptions of them singing the mass every day. Every day starts with a mass before they go to the field. So there's a lot of musical stuff going on, and it has a level of verisimilitude and historical record keeping. Obviously, it's not a documentary. It is a versification of an event. And in fact, the author talks about how this event is commissioned. He has his own patron that he goes to, and his patron says, please, will you put this into a poem and have it so I can keep it. And I think it is something which was designed as a record, not a document, but definitely a record that is meant to be realistic, if not entirely real. So that's why I think it's important. And it just was the case that many, many of the sorts of musical activities that are described in the tournament at Chevancy relate to the genres of songs which are collected in the song collection that follows it. So the fact that these two things were designed to go in a manuscript together, I think, again, it's part of a sort of set of materials that people can use.
I mean, one thing that comes out from both our conversation, but also from the book, is the possibility of a lot more in 308. And you've talked quite a bit about sort of, I guess, differentiating between the parts that are slightly older, the parts that relate to one on each other most sort of closely. And it really prompts the question of having done such a fascinating and really, I think, a book that's full of possibilities, where are you going next, both in terms of the kind of broader agenda, but also in terms of thinking about specific scholarship on 308?
Yeah, well, I'm actually just finishing a book on the Bestiary of Love, Richard de Fourneval's Bestiary of Love, which is a mid-13th century prose text that is in Douse 308 in its current state, but I don't think was necessarily, or we don't know whether it was bound with the other contents originally. This is a work that mixes a bestiary, which is normally something which is really about showing God's work in the world by discussing the natures of beasts. And it mixes that in with a love letter in which he's writing to his lady, who's clearly turned him down, and saying, please, 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 can you reconsider? Because I definitely, you know, still love you. It's actually an incredibly weird and sophisticated mashup of these two things, because the bestiary normally has this sort of Christological or sort of allegorical but theological side to it, and all of that is kind of taken out here, and instead we get this sort of unreliable first person speaker, and it's in prose but it seems very lyric in its sort of format. But this first person speaker is trying to appropriate scholastic discourse. It starts with a quotation from Aristotle, from the Metaphysics, in French, which it hadn't been translated into French in this period. But it starts with that, and he tries to bend this scholastic discourse into his, you know, as a way of supporting his wish to get inside the head of his beloved. And of course, getting inside her head is sort of a prelude to getting inside her knickers, essentially, if people wore knickers in the Middle Ages, which I don't think they did, but you get the point. I'm co-writing this, in fact, with French literature scholar Jonathan Morton, and he's written about a similar appropriation of philosophical ideas in the much better known and more widely disseminated Roman de la Rose. from the later 13th century. And we actually think this, that the Roman de la Rose was really influenced by Richard de Fournevelle's Bestiary of Love. We're going to make some sort of large claims there. So my work on the Bestiary of Love wasn't wasted because I'm able to sort of hive that off into a different book. The Bestiary of Love is actually very widely copied, and we're taking the manuscripts of it, of which there are about 20-something, and they're often heavily illustrated. We're taking them as a sort of record of the performance of the work. So again, I'm thinking about it being performative, about it being read aloud, and also about it being sort of semi-staged in some kind of way. I mean, it's not a theatre piece, but it is a piece where the first person nature of the work means that the person who would be reading it to the noble people who are listening to it in the court situation, and that person is essentially inhabiting that weird guy who is desperate to convince his lady that she should, you know, be like a pelican and peck her breast open and let him feed on her blood because. So I'm sort of trying again to imagine how this particular work had relevance to people's real lives, to people's, and when I say real lives, their real lives include their fantasy lives. And it's sort of seeing the fantasy and sexual scripting possibilities of medieval French literature more broadly, not just song culture, but other kinds of literature too, I think is something I would want to pursue a little bit more. The Bestiary of Love, whilst being a prose work, does actually quote some troubadour songs and has a sort of, it's framed as being anti-song. He says, I sent you all my best songs and you still turned me down. So now I'm not going to sing anymore. I'm going to, like the cockerel, I'm going to crow loudly. And that's his way of saying he's going to write in prose. So it's framed as being anti-song, but it's actually got a lot of noises and sounds, and a lot of the animals obviously are making their own particular songs.
And I guess early next year for that book?
Yes, I hope so. We're intending to get the final draft off to the press. We're contracted with Cornell University Press, and that's we've told them we're going to get it to them by the end of February. So I would hope that would mean that we would indeed see it appear early next year.